Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Yes, good evening, folks, and welcome to another edition of Wall Street Unspun. This is John Cataldo in again for Peter Schiff. Today is the Wednesday, April the 5th, and Peter is now back from Singapore. He did have two prior engagements that he, I guess, left off his calendar, but he will be back, I promise, 2 weeks from today. Peter will be back doing the live show, and he's got loads of things to talk about. But from now until then, I hope to continue to mix up the format a little bit. I hope you enjoyed last week when I had Axel Merck on the show, and I hope you enjoyed his commentary. As well, what I'm going to do, let me give you a little bit of background of how I'm going to treat the show the next two sessions. Today, I'm going to, for about the first 10 minutes, I'm going to go ahead and talk about just some of the economic news, some of the announcements. I know the dollar has been in a very nice decline in the last week, especially the last few days. I'll touch on that. And then after the first break, what I'm going to do is I'm going to replay Peter's workshop presentation at the Money Show in Orlando. I'm not sure if anybody got on and listened to it. You can get it by logging into the Money Show. You have to create a login, so it's a little bit of a pain to get in there. But what I'm going to do is go ahead and have Jason, have the radio show people queue up that presentation. It's about 46 minutes long, but it's wonderful. Peter is full of terrific thoughts, and when he's on CNBC and Bloomberg, a lot of times he doesn't have enough time to go into a lot of detail about how he sees things and talks about some of the simple, just the simple economic concepts to why there's so many problems, and just really kind of dumbs it down to a real simple, understandable concept. So if you haven't heard this before, or you haven't heard Peter speak live at any of these conferences, you'll really enjoy it because, again, he goes from beginning to end, and he talks about everything related to the dollar, and especially the U.S. I think the presentation is called The U.S. Bubble Economy, and he goes into really the whole story. So you'll really enjoy that. That's going to start here in about 7 or 8 minutes after the first break. And then what I'm going to do next week, while Peter is out one more week, I'm going to be very specific on stock ideas and ideas that we talk to our clients and talk to our prospects about here at Euro Pacific. This will get into the countries we like. It'll get into some of the industries. Remember the common denominator at Euro Pacific. We are looking for dividends. We're looking for safety. We're looking for dividends. We're not looking to get out of the U.S. and speculate and take on a whole nother level of risk. So I think you'll really enjoy really my version of dumbing it down or getting it down to specific stock ideas in specific countries. But you'll trust me, it's different from what Peter will give you. And when Peter gets back, you'll hear a lot about all the macro thoughts of Peter's. You'll hear a lot about some of the things that he learned over in Singapore and some of the things he saw at the mining conference. So there will be a lot for him to talk about. But let me do this. I only have about 5 minutes or so before we go to the first break. Let me give you a couple of things that we watched in the last week or so. The big news has been the dollar's decline. The dollar has been in a pretty steady decline for the last 5, 7, 10 days, and we're now breaking under. We usually track the dollar by watching the dollar index, and that index is trading about 88.40, 88.30, right in that level. And a break under the 88.50 level means that it looks like it's going to head even lower. The big news there, and China started the week off, I think it was Monday, but one of the Chinese officials, in fact, the vice chief of China's National People's Congress, talked about how China can stop buying dollar-denominated bonds and increase buying U.S. products and gradually lower its holdings of U.S. bonds. This came out on Monday, but it was a big announcement. There's no secret, China, a lot of these Asian countries hold way too many dollars. They need to, there's a limit where they can't take any more, they won't want any more. These are, people talk about where there's smoke, there's fire. This is one of those announcements where we're starting to see and starting to hear publicly them talk about moving away from the dollar. And I think the significant part of Monday, when our bond market sold off significantly and the dollar was down, I think the big takeaway there is that on Monday, the bonds in our country were sold in large amounts. There were a lot of people leaving our bond markets and selling our bonds. And the same day, the dollar was down significantly. So what that tells us is that there was a lot of foreign holders of U.S. bonds that were selling those instruments. That's one of the key, I think, one of the key ingredients we have to our dollar thesis, in that the dollar is heading a lot lower. When foreign governments and foreign central banks and just foreign buyers in general stop buying our bonds and stop buying our debt that we have to issue, we're in trouble. And that's where the dollar selling really accelerates. So Monday was a big day. And most of the week, we saw this type of selling take place, and the dollar now has dropped consistently. It's breaking below those levels. But again, the key is that these are foreign sellers of our bonds, and that's a big deal. So we're starting on our way. Another announcement, I know we had last week, we had the GDP, the final number for the Q4 GDP, and we had that, I think 1.7 was the final. So we thought initially that the 1.1, 1.2 level of the first announcement, they would revise that much higher. We got a 1.6 revision for the fourth quarter GDP. Well, we had one more slight revision up to 1.7, but that was it. So growth is really slowing as a result of, I think, the consumer running out of money. But that was released last week. This week, there wasn't a lot of significant news. I know both of the oil inventory numbers really affected oil. Certainly gold price is now at 592 and change. Gold continues to make multi-year highs. I know silver has been continuing to challenge the $11 level, so we're seeing that ball continue to roll on, and we should continue to see that. Wait until the dollar starts to really roll over, then keep an eye on gold and silver and all these precious metal prices. That's when it'll really get fun and really get interesting. One other comment looking at the notes. I think the big news today, which fueled the equity markets, was that the Kansas City Fed Governor Honig, let's see, what is his first name? Thomas Honig, in a speech last night, talked about the Federal Reserve being at the high end of neutral, meaning they have a target rate for inflation, and the Federal Reserve is pretty much going to take rates up one more time. 5% is where most people think that they'll pause. If you look at the Fed funds futures, where they price in the expectation of the Federal Reserve's Fed funds target, it looks like 5% now is pretty much the number most people are agreeing on. But the big news last night was it's a non-voting Fed governor, a non-voting voting member, but by him coming out and publicly saying that was pretty big news. So my take on where we are in the dollar, where we are in the U.S. markets, I think there's one more last hurrah for the U.S. equity markets, in that when the Federal Reserve announces that they are done and publicly make that very clear, you might see a slight relief rally in the U.S. markets as they believe now we're going to start rolling over. But I think the big key is that we're starting to already see that relief rally taking place. And if you look at the equity markets, the stock market in our country, we're already reflecting, I think, the anticipation of that. So I wouldn't be surprised when the Fed announces that they're done, that the market actually sells off. So we'll have to keep an eye on it. These are all we talk about. When I talk to my clients here, we talk about signposts. We talk about things to keep an eye on to know that it's time to really get money away from the dollar. But the significance of when the Fed is done, we're seeing it now. Just as the stock market is anticipating the end of this, so is the U.S. dollar. And what we're seeing is the dollar's now rolling over. When we get to the end and places like Europe and other central banks are still raising interest rates, and that differential is not as large in the U.S. and you can't get as much for your short rates here as you can overseas, or that differential decreases, our dollar starts to see a lot of weakness. So we're seeing that right now. But those are by far the biggest couple events that we've had here, and I'd say in the last week or so. I can certainly talk about a lot of things related to the housing markets. There's always fun and exciting things to talk about there. And I've also got one more terrific article about Australia. And there's a headline, and this might be a month old, but I think publicly it was just released in the last few days. But it talked about Australia is now going to start selling uranium to China. A great article that talked about it's specifically for energy use, but that's key. Australia is one of our favorite investment destinations. Australia supplies, Western Australia specifically, supplies a lot of raw materials and things to China. And I think this is another one of those announcements where it even strengthens our belief that Australia is a terrific investment destination because of all the raw materials. In fact, Australia holds about 40% of the world's reserves of easily extractable uranium. So that's a really key, I think, a key announcement. And one of the most, I think, most interesting features of this article, it talks about China's actually now allowed to invest in the Australian uranium industry. So it's another one of those important events where we like Australia. We like countries that export things to fuel the growth of China, India. That's part of our, you know, multi-tier strategy. Next week, I promise you folks, I will have a lot of specifics about our countries, investment ideas. I'll get very specific on the names that I talk to my clients all day long and people who call and want to inquire. I'll give you the number of my branch here. I am in the Phoenix office. I run the Phoenix branch as well as the West Coast operations. You can reach my office at 1-800-727-6435. I've got a whole staff of brokers here that can answer your questions. I think next week's show should prompt a bunch of you to want to pick up the phone and learn a little bit more about some of these companies that we're talking about. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and go to the first break, and we're going to go ahead and after the break, we're going to hopefully be able to queue up Peter Schiff's presentation from the Orlando Money Show just about 60 days ago, talking about the bubble economy and the implications for the U.S. dollar and other assorted things. Thank you very much, and I may not speak to you again until next week, but thank you for bearing with us in this format change of the show just temporarily, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
You know, many people don't understand why it is that we have a bubble economy. They confuse America's current economy with some viable, long-term viable situation. And that's not the case. See, we have an economy today that is based on a false premise that we can consume and borrow while the rest of the world saves and produces. And that somehow this relationship where we consume and everybody else produces is somehow a symbiotic relationship that will be able to persist indefinitely. That the world somehow benefits from our consumption simply because they get jobs. And this theory, I think, is a very dangerous theory, which has resulted in these tremendous economic imbalances, which I think we are on the verge of finally resolving. I think first, you got to look back at what made America such a great and powerful and wealthy nation in the first place. You know, America became wealthy and we consumed so much of the world's resources because we produced so much. America at one time flooded the world with high quality, low cost manufactured goods. And the world wanted our currency because they wanted our stuff. They wanted to buy all the things that we manufactured. All the automobiles, all the consumer electronics. I mean, everything was made in the United States. You know, back in the 1950s, nobody would buy a product that was made in Japan. I mean, if something didn't work, the expression in the 1950s was what? Was it made in Japan? You know, they made trinkets. You know, they actually named the city. Some of you might remember this. They actually named the city in Japan, Yusa. So they can write on the label, made in USA. And somebody might buy it. And we produced, I mean, everything that we made was not only high quality, but it was low cost. Even though we paid the highest wages in the world, nobody earned more than Americans. That's not true today. Our wage scales are nowhere near the highest. But back then, even though we paid our workers more money than any workers anywhere in the world, our products were the lowest cost. And it was because of the capital. You know, back in the 1950s, if you wanted to impress your friends by your wealth, you know, you might brag about the fact that you had imported products. And you might say, you see this necktie? It's imported. It's imported. That meant it was expensive. That meant you had money. You can afford to buy imported products. Now, if you're worried, you know, why is that so cheap? Oh, it's imported. Then it's all the cheap things that are imported. And why did we have so much capital in the United States? Why were we able to pay high wages? Because we have capital. Where did that capital come from? It came from savings. Savings is where capital comes from. It's under consumption, which allows an economy to grow. It provides the capital necessary to expand an economy. So what made America great was our high savings rate and our manufacturing. And what enabled that to happen was the fact that we were free. We were a free people. We had less regulations and lower taxes than the rest of the world. And because we were freer, we produced more. And because we produced more, we consumed more. It was production that allowed us to consume. Not the other way around. It wasn't our consumption that allowed us to produce. It's the production that's the engine that drives the economic train. Not consumption. Anyway, where are we today in the United States? Well, today, our industry is gone, by and large. I mean, we don't produce nothing, but we don't produce nearly as much as we consume. The result is close to a $70 billion monthly trade deficit. $70 billion. That represents the difference between what we produce and what we consume. And in order to finance this trade deficit, the rest of the world has to loan us money. And in the process, they're accumulating vast quantities of our IOUs, predominantly in U.S. government bonds, but also in corporate bonds, mortgage-backed securities, all sorts of interest and or dividend-paying instruments. They also buy our stocks. And in the process of the last 20 years, as a result of this, the United States has gone from the world's wealthiest creditor nation to its largest debtor. And just recently, we finally passed a point where net investment flows are negative, where Americans are paying more interest and dividends on foreign assets than we're earning on our assets abroad. And that's about to really compile, because as interest rates rise, the burden of servicing this debt grows. Because most of this debt is in short-term paper. But let me explain very briefly trade, because a lot of people don't understand and get confused about how trade works and what trade's all about. They think that the Asians, the Chinese, and the Japanese are benefiting from their trade relationships with the United States. And therefore, they think these relationships will be ongoing. They think that Japan and China cannot afford to allow our currency to collapse because that would kill their own economies because therefore they can no longer export to the United States. And this is all a bunch of nonsense because you don't export to export. You don't export to create jobs. I mean, that's nonsense. The only reason you export, and there's only one reason that you export, and that's to import. That's it. It's called comparative advantage. One nation will produce the goods that it can produce efficiently and trade them with other nations for goods that those nations produce more efficiently than they do. And everybody does what they do best, and they trade. And everybody has more products because everybody concentrates on the productions of those goods that they have a comparative advantage in over their trading partners. And everybody benefits. But what's happening with the United States is that we're not producing goods that anybody wants. And so what we're doing is instead of paying for our imports with exports, we're asking our trading partners to accept IOUs instead of exports. And basically what those IOUs represent is claims on future American exports. So we're like the wimpy character on Popeye. You know, we'll gladly pay you Wednesday for some products today. And so we give them these IOUs. And, you know, foreigners are holding on to them, but they're not noticing the fact that our factories that we would need to produce those products are no longer here. And I usually try to explain, as best to explain trade, by using an example. And I think the easiest way to look at it is if you just break it down to its simplest form. Take two farmers. One farmer grows apples. Another farmer grows oranges. And the two farmers at the end of the year exchange apples for oranges. And as a result, each individual farmer enjoys more fruit because each one concentrates only on the fruit that his land is most suited to grow. Now, say one year, the orange farmer has a frost and his crop is destroyed. And so at the end of the year, he comes down to trade and with the apple farmer, and he's got no oranges to trade. Now, the apple farmer probably has more apples than he cares to eat anyway, because he was intending on trading them for some oranges. And the orange farmer doesn't want to go hungry, so he comes up with a suggestion. He says to the apple farmer, let me give you an IOU for oranges. I don't have any oranges now, but I'm going to grow more next year. So let me give you an IOU for oranges, and I'll give you 10% more for interest. And the apple farmer figures, all right, you know, I mean, better than letting these apples rot, and I'll get more oranges next year. So they make the trade. Now, the orange farmer hasn't actually paid for his apples yet. He's given an IOU. He's going to have to pay for those apples next year. Now, let's say another year goes by. Another natural disaster hits the orange farmer. They get together, make the same deal. Let's say this goes on for a few years, and pretty soon the orange farmer starts to think about this situation and says, you know, this is a great deal. I'm not working, I'm not growing any oranges, but I'm eating. And maybe he decides that he doesn't even want to be a farmer anymore. He'd rather, you know, play golf all day, so he turns his orange grove into a golf course. You know, he's running a service economy, he just plays golf. And the apple farmer, he forgets why he's exporting apples. He thinks he's exporting apples to earn these little pieces of paper. He forgot that the original reason he accepted those pieces of the paper was because they were IOUs for oranges. He's not exporting apples just to get these little pieces of paper. But it's been so long since he actually had any oranges that he's confused. And maybe our apple farmer even has the ability to take those pieces of paper, those IOUs from the orange farmer, and circulate them in the community among other farmers. Maybe he's able to take those IOUs, because this orange farmer's got a good reputation, and maybe he's able to trade them. Other people will accept these IOUs in exchange for pears, or, you know, or whatever he wants to buy, or maybe articles of clothing, or pieces of furniture. Because everybody knows that this orange farmer is good for it. Oh, you got an IOU from, you know, they'll take it. They're not taking the piece of paper because they want the piece of paper. They want the oranges that it represents. the promise to pay something real. But eventually, somebody's going to get wise. They're going to notice that this orange grove is gone. That there's just a golf course there. That there's no way to get any oranges. And at that point, people in the community are not going to take those IOUs. And the apple farmer is going to wake up to a worthless pile of IOUs for oranges from a farm that no longer exists. And he's going to stop taking them. Because he's been wasting his time. He's been producing apples and getting nothing in exchange. While this orange farmer has been living off of his labor. Now, once the apple farmer wises up, the orange farmer's stuck. Because now he has no farm and he has no way to pay for food. So he's the one that's in trouble. Not the apple farmer. He's now liberated. He's now realized how he was getting, you know, screwed by the orange farmer, and he's not doing it anymore. And that's the situation that America is going to face when the world wakes up to the fact that the America of the 1940s and 50s and 60s, the America that is the reason that they're holding all these dollars in the first place, that America no longer exists. That the low tax, low regulation, capitalist, you know, economy, the arsenal of democracy, the producer of goods flooding the world with low cost, high quality goods, that America's gone. It's just a memory. And all that remains is a low, high tax, high regulation, no savings, no production, consumption, phony economy. And the world is not benefiting in its quest to accumulate our IOUs because they're worthless. Because we don't have the ability to produce the goods that would be necessary to make those IOUs whole. And the whole concept that Asia, in particular Japan and China, depend on us, because without us, they'd have nobody to sell their products to, is nonsense. You know, demand is unlimited. Anybody can demand. Anybody can consume. The key is to produce. When you produce, you get to consume. The fact is, without us, the Chinese and the Japanese would simply consume their own products themselves. And they'd be better off. They'd certainly be better off enjoying the consumption of what they produce than just taking little bits of paper that we print while we enjoy the consumption. Then I wrote an article about this on my website. And, you know, there's a lot of really good commentary on my site. If you haven't been there, at www.europac.net. I post a lot of these economic commentaries that I write. I usually write about one a week. And I don't know, about a year ago, I wrote one. And I got a lot of favorable reaction to it and it really helped explain the situation or shed some light on this myth of about America's role in the global economy. And it basically, I had a situation where a group of castaways were stranded on an island. And five of them happened to be Asian, and there was one American. And they get stranded on this island, and they got to divvy up the work. So one of the Asians, he gets assigned the job of fishing, catching fish. The other one is assigned the job of, you know, scavenging for vegetation. Another one has to hunt. Another one gets the job of gathering firewood and tending to the fire. And then the last one, he has the job of actually preparing the meal and cooking. And then it comes to the American. So, well, what's his job going to be? Well, he gets assigned the job of eating. And so, all day long, these five Asians are out there doing their jobs, working, while the American lies on the beach, sunning himself, waiting to enjoy his meal that the Asians are going to produce. And so at the end of the day, they all get together in front of this big table, the American sits down, and they serve him his dinner. And, you know, the American, understandably, doesn't want all these Asians to starve, because they have to repeat the thing again tomorrow. So he just leaves just enough crumbs so that the agents can eat enough so that they can go out all day the next day and repeat the exercise. Now, a modern economist would take a look at this little island economy, and he would conclude that the American was the engine behind the whole thing. That without his ravenous appetite, these five Asians would be unemployed. But they'd have nothing to do. Now, the reality is that the five Asians who were working to prepare this meal for the American could easily consume the food themselves. They don't need the American to eat it. And there's no great, you know, enjoyment out of doing the work. I mean, theoretically, if they didn't have to feed the American, maybe they wouldn't have to work so hard, and they can lie on the beach themselves. You know, leisure has a value, and, you know, there's no reason for them to have to waste all their time. You know, it also reminds me of that book, or about Tom Sawyer. And probably the most famous passage in the Tom Sawyer novel is when Tom is able to convince all the boys in his neighborhood to paint his fence for him. And not only to paint his fence, but to pay him for the privilege of painting his fence. And the reason he was able to do that is he was able to convince them that there was this great joy and satisfaction involved in doing the work. And he was going to allow them to experience that joy and satisfaction if they paid him. Meanwhile, he just kicked back, you know, while everybody else did his chores. Now, little did Mark Twain know that little passage would one day form the basis of the global economy. That America would have all the world out there painting its fence for them and thinking that somehow they're benefiting from their labor. But the whole idea behind an economy is not to produce more work, but to produce less work. The whole idea is to have more leisure. That's what it's all about. I mean, that's what new productivity is. It's labor-saving devices. It's so we can eliminate the need to work, not create work. Work's not the goal. Work's the means to the end. The end is to enjoy your life, to consume. But Americans have skipped all that, and we're just at the consumption. But that's not going to continue. Anyway, to go into the recent past and the real roots of this last, you know, 5 or 6 years of this bubble economy, you got to go back to the internet bubble, the stock market bubble of the late 1990s. I hope many of you in this room probably remember that bubble. But anyway, we had a tremendous bubble, and the bubble finally burst in 2000. Now, during the bubble, you have all sorts of malinvestments that are made. Capital is allocated inefficiently. All kinds of cockamamie, harebrained ventures were funded during the 1990s. Companies that never should have got capital. And a lot of people were employed in businesses that had no viability. And the result of the bursting of this bubble should have been a tremendous recession as those malinvestments were purged. However, this recession began shortly after the election of George Bush. And George Bush did not want this significant recession to occur during his first term. Rather than trying to correctly blame the recession on the false boom of the Clinton administration, rather than do that, he wanted to make sure that it didn't hit the fan on his watch. So what did he do in conjunction with Alan Greenspan as they pursued the most combination of the most irresponsible monetary and fiscal policy in U.S. history? And they cut taxes, they increased government spending, and Alan Greenspan brought interest rates down to nothing. And the result was Americans went on a consumption binge, a borrow and spending binge, which kept the economy expanding instead of contracting like it should have been as business fixed investment pulled back. Now, the government tells us that we had a recession in whatever it was, 2001 or 2002. The problem is we didn't have a recession. We needed one. See, the business cycle, it's the boom where the problems are created. It's the boom that's false. The bust, the recession, is the cleansing process. That's what the economy needs to get back to normalcy, to get back to economic viability. Politicians don't want the bust because the bust is where all the pain comes. Nobody wants that. They want to keep us in the boom because it feels good. The best analogy that I use to explain it is just a heroin addict. You know, when you're high on heroin, right? I mean, it feels good. Everybody, you enjoy it. I mean, at least that's what they tell me anyway. But I mean, you're high. When you want to get off the drug, you know, you're going to go through a period of withdrawal. You know, as the toxins are purged from your system. And withdrawal is a very difficult, unpleasant experience. Again, so I'm told. But the point is that the withdrawal is necessary. Nobody wants it. But it's a necessary price to pay to get healthy. You've got to experience it. Well, the same thing happens with an artificial economy. The Federal Reserve shoots it up with a drug of cheap money. And, you know, you get these malinvestments and you get all kinds of crazy things that happen in response to the false signals this inflation sends to the economy. Then, when you try to take the drug away, and these malinvestments are exposed, they need to be corrected. And the correction process often involves unemployment, people have to stop spending, people have to sacrifice, you know. It's unpleasant, and no politician wants that recession on his watch, so they fight it. They try to postpone it. But they're not doing anybody any favors by postponing that correction process. All they're doing is allowing bigger problems to build up. You know, we don't have a recession with, we had, you know, record car sales and record home sales, which is what we had during the theoretical recession of 2001 or 2002. Nobody retrenched. Nobody denied themselves anything in this recession. Nobody paid back debt. I mean, every other recession we've ever had, consumers used the recession to repay debt. They took on too much debt during the boom. Now they got to pay it back. What happened in this last recession? Consumers took on even more debt. When the recession was over, they had more debt than when it began. Now we have more debt than ever before. What did Greenspan do to keep this bubble economy growing with his low interest rate policy? He blew up the biggest speculative bubble in U.S. history in real estate that dwarfs the bubble that we had in the stock market. Now what's going to happen when this bubble bursts? I mean, there's no other bubble left for him to blow up. And if we had problems in 2000 at the end of the stock market bubble, we have them in spades now with the real estate bubble. I mean, our current account deficit has gone through the roof because of the real estate bubble. Our savings rate is gone through the floor. We've had a negative savings rate for 8 of the last 9 months. Now, and we've accumulated debt at a pace never before seen in world history. All because of the fact that Alan Greenspan and George Bush did not want a sharp recession happening during his first term. Instead, it might happen during his second term, or maybe during the term of whoever replaces him. But we are in for a major, major recession. I mean, I don't even think they're going to call it a recession by the time it's over. I mean, they might have to rename the Great Depression. But this is going to be a very, very wrenching period of time. And the result is going to be a rapid and substantial reduction in the American standard of living. There is no question about that. We are still living a standard that is inconsistent with our collective productivity. We are consuming far more than we produce. The rest of the world is consuming less than they produce. We're living above our means, financed by a group of other people living below their means. Now, what's going to happen, I think, to unravel the situation is as interest rates start to rise, and they're already rising, as they continue to rise, the ability of Americans to service their debt is going to be diminished. In addition, Americans have a lot of floating rate debt. The federal government, we have a national debt of $8 trillion plus. It's financed with treasury bills. We weren't smart enough to finance it with 30-year bonds. It's financed with T-bills. The average maturity on the U.S. national debt is 2 to 3 years. So as interest rates rise, it becomes increasingly expensive for America, the U.S. government, to pay the interest on the national debt, which is now owned better than 50% by foreigners, 50%, which means those income payments, those interest payments represent a net drain on our national income. You've got unprecedented amounts of Americans who have adjustable rate mortgages, particularly in places like California, where 90+% of the mortgages that have been taken out in recent years are adjustable rate. Better than 50% of them are interest-only adjustable rates. So as interest rates rise, these mortgages are going to be that much more difficult to finance. You know, a lot of Americans are going to see their mortgage payments over the next few years double, literally double. And since the mortgage payment now already consumes 40 or 50% of their income, how are they going to pay a mortgage that's twice? Assuming they can even do it, I mean, they have no savings to draw. I mean, they're going to have to completely stop consuming. And in fact, as Americans have to pay more and more money in interest to finance the consumption of the past, they're going to have very little money left to consume in the present or the future. Which means all the employment that is contingent on that consumption is going to go away. People who make their living in the service industry are not going to be able to get a paycheck anymore if their customers are spending so much of their income making mortgage payments to the Chinese and the Japanese. There's nothing left to spend on discretionary items. Plus other items that they have to buy, like energy and food, are going to keep getting more expensive. You know, despite the fact that the government, with their ridiculous concept of the core CPI, is trying to tell us that we don't have to worry about rising prices because we don't care about food and energy, those are the two most important things that everybody buys. And if the price is going up for those, you can't buy anything else because you've got to eat. You need energy. You got to heat your house. You got to drive your car. You got to get to work. So as Americans are struggling to cover the rising costs of necessities and to make interest payments abroad, there's no money left. Now, what's been financing all this borrowing has been the inflated value of our real estate. Well, real estate prices are already starting to subside, and the glut of unsold houses is already building in the market. And that glut of unsold houses is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Because so many people in the last few years bought houses and condos, not because they needed to live in them, but because they were speculating on their appreciation. All sorts of people bought second homes, third homes, investment properties, without tenants. People didn't even care that they couldn't rent their properties out, that they couldn't get a rental income. I had arguments with realtors where they told me I didn't understand real estate, that rents had nothing to do with it. That cash flow meant nothing. It was the same ridiculous arguments that people were making about stocks in the 1990s. That stocks, that dividends didn't matter, that earnings didn't matter, that I didn't get it. That it was a new economy, it was a new era, that prices were just going to rise. Well, that's how people think about real estate. Prices are just going to rise. Who cares if I can't rent it out for a good return? Because some other fool is going to come around and pay an even more outrageous price than I did. And accept an even lower return. Well, now that prices are starting to come down, and that the supply of real estate is growing, the speculators are going to leave the market. And as that happens, those have been the buyers. I mean, home ownership is already at a record high. There are very few people left that don't own homes that are going to buy them. So, the prices will start to come down. As they start to come down, the banking system is going to start to reimpose some lending standards. See, one of the things that happened during the real estate bubble is banks threw all their lending standards out the window. Since real estate prices were rising, nobody cared about default. Nobody cared about anything. It didn't matter because the rising market was going to bail them out. So anybody can get a mortgage in the United States. You don't need a job. You don't need any good credit history. You can have bankruptcies. Nothing. They have these mortgages called stated income. They're basically called liar's mortgages among the realtors. You just write whatever you want. What's your income? Whatever it has to be to get approved. Put nothing down. I mean, why would you lend somebody money who has no collateral? They got no skin in the game. I mean, they got no incentive. I mean, you give people an incentive. You say, look, how'd you like to buy this condo for nothing? And you can get an interest-only adjustable rate mortgage. That the teaser rate is so low that you can live there for 2 or 3 years, and it's cheaper than rent. You don't have to pay us anything. That means, you know, when you rent an apartment, you got to put down a security deposit, you got to put down first and last. They made it cheaper to buy a house than rent. And landlords, I mean, most landlords wouldn't let you rent an apartment unless you can prove you had some income. But the banks didn't care. You know, we'll just lend you whatever you want. And the public said, sure, because they got nothing to lose on these no down payment mortgages. If the price of the house goes up, they refinance and they cash out some money. If it goes down, they give the keys to the bank. And that's what's going to happen. You're going to see record amounts of foreclosures and defaults once real estate prices start to decline and mortgage interest payments are rising. People are not going to struggle to make a mortgage payment on a house where they have no equity, particularly if the mortgage is $500,000 and the market value of the house is $400,000. Why are they going to struggle to make a payment when they have negative equity, when there's plenty of rentals around that they can rent? And then as the banks start to see this, as they start to see all the real estate for sale, and they realize that, wait a minute, if we get a foreclosure, we're stuck. We can't sell this house. There's 5 years worth of supply on the market. Banks are going to start to get worried. They're going to start to contract, restrict credit. All of a sudden, they're going to require 20% down payments again, maybe more. They're going to require stringent credit checks. Maybe they're going to realize that, you know what, these interest-only mortgages, they're too risky. I mean, you know, the whole idea behind home ownership and why home ownership was a good investment for people was because it was a forced savings. They took out a 30-year mortgage, and over the course of 30 years, they paid it off. And now they could retire because they owned a home free and clear. You know, they would have a party. You would burn your mortgage, and you could retire because you didn't have to pay it anymore. Today, that whole concept is completely gone. Nobody retires a mortgage. People are just taking interest-only mortgages. That means you never pay a quarter of principal. You're never out of debt. And you just constantly borrow money against the theoretical appreciated value of your house. But the problem is these phony house values that exist today are no more real than the valuations of the dot-com stocks of the 1990s. They only exist for a brief period of time. And it's only because there was a fool who was willing to pay an absurd price and a banker who was willing to lend him the money to buy it. But that situation is not going to exist forever. Just because somebody was willing to pay $200 a share, you know, for e-toys at one point in 1999 doesn't mean those people are going to be around in 2005 when the company is bankrupt. It's just represented just one brief lapse of judgment and sanity on the part of the buyers and the lenders. Because those values do not make sense based on the relative rental incomes that are available on those houses. And, you know, a condo, why should a condo that was worth $300,000 a few years ago be worth $1 million today? It's the same condo. Nothing has changed. Of course, the real estate community will try to come up with all kinds of reasons to rationalize this insanity and try to talk about demographics or come up with some kind of arguments to justify the irrationality instead of admitting that it's a bubble. It's the same way that the stock market analysts were rationalizing the mania of the 1990s rather than admitting the bubble. They had all these concepts of, you know, click views and page views and new kinds of valuation metrics to try to justify the nonsense. But it's going to end. The problem is with this bubble is our economy is based on it. So when the real estate market collapses, Americans no longer have assets that they can pledge to borrow against. The consumption stops. The jobs stop. The bubble economy implodes. And the dollar collapses. Oh, only got 5 minutes? And the dollar collapses. And then what we have is a major transformation of global purchasing power from Americans to the rest of the world. Because finally, what's going to free up purchasing power? What's going to enable the Chinese and the Japanese, or the Chinese and a lot of people in Southeast Asia to consume a lot more is when the dollar finally collapses and their currencies rise. The purchasing power that we lose shows up over there. Now all of a sudden, instead of producing a product and shipping it to California, the Chinese realize that now they can afford to consume it themselves because their currencies have gained so much value. It's now the Americans that are too poor to buy them and the Chinese that can afford them. And what I want to try to make sure that I help my clients do is to be on the receiving end of this transformation, to own the assets that are going to gain value, to own those currencies. And physically, you know, we're not moving, you're not leaving the United States, But you can have your money leave the dollar. You can have your investments denominated in all these other currencies against which the dollar is going to decline. And therefore, what you will be able to do is preserve your own purchasing power by having income-producing assets that will pay you dividends in these currencies that are gaining value, which will directly increase your purchasing power here in the United States relative to Americans who are counting on dollars. Now, first of all, I wanted to point out, we passed out all these index cards when you came into the room. Make sure that you fill out these cards, you put your name, and most importantly, your phone number, so we can contact you and discuss these strategies with you in more detail and more specifics on the specific stock that we're recommending for you to own to help preserve your wealth. And you definitely want to make sure that we contact you. It's extremely important. Don't wait, to contact us, because a lot of people, the natural tendency is to procrastinate. This is too important a decision. People work a lifetime to preserve their wealth. They don't want to stand by and watch it evaporate. You really got to take protective actions now to protect what you've accumulated. And that's what the presentation later on today is going to focus on. It's going to focus on what we're doing at Euro Pacific Capital, how we are positioning our clients in conservative dividend-paying foreign stocks. I mean, we're helping clients invest internationally not to assume risk, but to escape risk. The risk is here in the United States. A lot of people want to invest conservatively, but the problem is you can't do that if you're investing in the United States, because all of your investments are denominated in dollars. They're based on the dollar. And if the dollar itself is not sound, then you can't make a conservative investment. The whole idea behind conservative is to conserve. And what is it that we want to conserve is purchasing power. We don't want to conserve the quantity of dollars that we have. That's meaningless if they don't buy anything. We want to conserve the purchasing power that our dollars represent. And it's the dollar's purchasing power that's in great jeopardy. Because what I believe will happen is because the Federal Reserve, because Ben Bernanke, does not want the real estate bubble to implode, does not want the stock market bubble to implode, does not want to see this massive recession, does not want all these Americans to be unemployed and to lose their homes. What he's going to do to try to stop it is what central bankers have always done, print money. But in Bernanke, he's already promised to do it. He's already talked about doing it. And when you do that, all you're doing is debasing your currency. And that's what he's going to do. That's why gold is moving. That's why gold is, though, $570 an ounce and rising. It's in response to the debasement of the U.S. dollar and other foreign currencies. So what you've got to do is conserve your purchasing power, and you can't do that in U.S. financial assets. You've got to do that by investing abroad. And there are great valuations around the world. I mean, we're able to identify very conservative companies, utilities, property trusts, natural resource companies, oil and gas, all sorts of sound businesses that you can buy around the world, in Asia, in Singapore, in Hong Kong, in New Zealand, in Australia, in Canada, in Switzerland, in the Netherlands, all around the world. We can get good values buying stocks trading at less than 10 times their earnings and get dividend yields 7, 8, 9, 10, 12%. Real yields. Not just some hype. When most of the people at this conference are talking to you about buying stocks, they don't pay any dividends. They want you to buy a stock because they think it's going to go up. Well, why should it go up if it doesn't even pay a dividend based on its current price? This is all speculation. What we want to do is invest. We don't want to gamble. We want to own businesses where we get compensated with dividends. We want to share in the profits. We don't want all the profits going to the employees in stock options and bonuses. We want the profits going to us, the shareholders. So you got to invest around the world for dividends. And, especially today with the tax treatment, the favorable tax treatment for dividends, you don't have to own a domestic stock to get the favorable tax treatment. Those lower taxes apply to dividend income no matter where in the world you earn it. And there are very interesting companies. The fact is that a lot of these economies around the world, a lot of these markets, they had bear markets for a long time in stocks, and so their valuations are good. You don't have a bunch of fools, just overpaying for stocks. So we can go into these markets, and we can buy investments and get good yields for our money. But more importantly, these dividends are coming to us in euros, in Swiss francs, in Australian dollars, in New Zealand dollars, in Canadian dollars. And though we convert these currencies to dollars for you, when we get them, the value of these dividends will rise as the dollar falls. And so as the cost of living in the United States continues to rise, and it's going to rise sharply, by having your investments abroad, you've got an income stream that will also rise to compensate you. So as it costs more money to live, you've got more money to spend because your euros and your New Zealand dollars are translating into a greater quantity of U.S. dollars. And so what you're able to do is you're able to position yourself to be on the winning end of that transfer that I talked about. The transformation of purchasing power or the reallocation of purchasing power away from Americans who are holding dollars to holders of other currencies. That has to happen. Our consumption has to be brought into line with our production. You know, and the fact that we've consumed so much today means we're going to have to consume less in the future. The fact that the rest of the world has saved means that they're going to enjoy greater consumption because they're going to be able to consume their savings plus the interest on their savings in the future. We're going to have to rebuild our stock of savings. We're going to have to rebuild our manufacturing infrastructure. And that's going to require a big diminishment in our standard of living. You've got a decision that you can make that you don't want to have that happen to you. You don't want to see the value of your financial assets collapse out from under you. You can take decisive action to preserve your wealth. There's nothing that I can do to help you preserve the value of your wages if you're still working and earning dollars. I mean, that's going to be a problem for American wage earners who are going to see the value of their incomes decline and their living standards decline. But if you've already accumulated wealth, we can do something to preserve the real value and the real purchasing power of your savings. So anyway, make sure to come to the second part of this later on this afternoon. We have part two where we're going to talk a little bit more about what Euro Pacific Capital does specifically, how we're different from other brokerage firms, how we can help you access global markets more cost effectively than your traditional broker. Also, make sure again to visit our website at www.europac.net. I do a weekly radio show every week on that website. You can also hear it on shortwave. It's called Wall Street Unspun. I do it every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific time. There are a lot of economic commentaries, like I said, that you can read on there. There's a lot of articles where I've been quoted in the press. A lot of valuable information that you can get from spending some time on that website. And I want to thank everybody for attending, and thank everybody for listening. This is the first time we've done a webcast, so hopefully a lot of people will be able to access this presentation on the internet. And if any of you have friends that you think should have seen this presentation, they can access it on the Money Show website, and they can listen to it whenever they want. Thanks.
Okay, folks, thank you very much for listening to this edition of Wall Street Unspun. This is John Cataldo in for Peter Schiff. One more week. Peter will be back the week after next, or 2 weeks from tonight. What you've been listening to, the recorded seminar or workshop from the Money Show in Orlando. But I hope you enjoyed it. But what we're going to do and what I'm going to do is talk about specific ideas and go into a lot of specifics about what we invest in and why. So I really think a little different than what Peter does, but I really think you'll enjoy it. If you'd like to reach us, it's www.europac.net. The number is 800-727-6435. Thank you, and we'll talk to you all next week. Thank you.